welcome everyone. And today we have a special guest, John Graham. He's the chairman and president of Giraffe Heroes organization. He was for many years part of U.S. Senate staff. And tell us, John, welcome and a pleasure to have you here.
I'm delighted to be here, Julio. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. So, John, so tell us a bit about yourself for the sake of the audience and for them to know. Who is John Graham? You know, what have you been inspiring people for so many years? And what have you been doing on the background all this time?
Sure. I'm an American born in Washington State, and my first career was as a Foreign Service officer, an American diplomat. And that was after a lot of years of taking a lot of risks as a young man. I must tell your listeners that I'm lucky to be alive. I once counted, by the time I was 40 years old, I'd escaped a violent death a dozen times, either from mountain climbing, where I've done a lot of serious mountain climbing, or in my Foreign Service career, where I didn't work in embassies wearing fancy clothes. I worked in jungles and deserts dealing with wars and revolutions, all very dangerous work, and sometimes I was shot at. So anyway, that was the Foreign Service career. And then at a certain point in my life, you know, things begin to change. It all started in a battle in Vietnam. I was in Vietnam for a year and a half, very dangerous part of the country. And up until that point in my life, I must say my life was considerably shallow, I'll be honest. The only thing that mattered to me was adventure. I think I was an adrenaline junkie, you might say. I was pretty sure nothing would ever kill me, so I kept going into one ridiculously dangerous situation after the other. But at a certain point, I realized that was a very shallow life. There was something in my heart. There was something that wasn't right. I saw all the suffering, the pain, some of which I was causing. And something hit me that I had to do better. If I was going to live a life, I had to do something that made a difference to other people and not just in a negative way. And that battle in Vietnam, it really came home to me that there I was in the middle of a kill or be killed situation. And I didn't believe in the war. I hated the war. I knew America would lose. I was just there for the adventure. And it was so shallow. I was ashamed. I got out of it alive, but it really began to change me. And the change started there, the battle in Vietnam. And it went through a couple iterations, but 8 years later or so, I was at the United Nations, and I was in charge of America's policies toward much of the so-called third world in Africa. And I am very proud to say that I fought hard to help end apartheid, for example, and to try and create a better deal for the poor nations of the world in terms of trade and aid and to get them a place in the sun, so to speak, where up to that point they'd be ignored by America and most of Europe. Sure. So that began to change. And then finally, what really brought it home to me was I left the Foreign Service because at that point I realized that simply doing someone else's bidding wasn't what I wanted to do, especially working for a great power diplomatic arm where it was very transactional. And I don't think anyone...
A lot of difference of interest between your personal interest and...
Yeah, that's right. It was a real difference of interest, especially on the interests of apartheid. Issues like that, there are a lot of forces in the American government and in American corporations, and I must say in Europe, that wanted not to rock the boat, that wanted to keep things the way they were, mostly in order to make money. For example, selling guns to the South African military and police, because that was very lucrative business. And so I fought that, and my government said, no, don't fight it. I mean, just forget it, John. Just go slow. Play the game. Well, I wasn't about to play the game anymore, so I quit.
And, so which year was this? This was back in...
1980.
1980.
Yeah, almost a quarter century ago, 1980. No, sure, more than that. Sure. 1980. It's 2024. Anyway, yeah, and so, but then again, so I started re-earning my life toward seeing where I could be of service, because, you know, I was smart and I was tough. I had a lot of skills and I had a lot of experience in negotiating and dealing with powerful people in my Foreign Service career. So I had a lot to offer and I wanted to offer it in a good way. Not to try to solve some of the problems in the world, including environmental and sustainability issues, poverty, crimes against women, corruption, poor leadership, everything out there that needs fixing in the world. I thought I could make a difference doing that. But it was tough because, you know, all of a sudden I was without a regular paycheck. I was not working for the U.S. government anymore. And so I got scared. And I had a strong temptation to back out and to take a soft job someplace, go work the rest of my life for a bank or something, because, you know, being an activist, being a change agent is tough. It's scary. And there I was in New York City, really without a dollar to my name almost. I mean, I
sure.
So I ended up lecturing on cruise ships. I don't know if you know this, if you've ever taken a fancy cruise ship, but they hire people, experts like me, to give little speeches. They don't care what you talk about. They just want to entertain all the old people who are on there for their cruises. And so I was on this cruise ship, and the darn if the cruise ship didn't catch fire and sink in the Gulf of Alaska, and I found myself fighting for my life in a lifeboat.
Amazing.
Oh, amazing is right. I mean, I was within another hours of death once again, because I was in a lifeboat. It was a typhoon. The waves were 30 feet high. And there were eight of us in the lifeboat. The helicopters couldn't fly anymore because of the typhoon. We were 140 miles off the coast, so a long ways away from rescue. Our only hope was a Coast Guard boat was out there in the middle of the storm looking for us, but it couldn't find us because the visibility was so low. So I realized I was probably going to die this time. I probably, my luck had run out.
Amazing.
But then there was a miracle. There was a miracle. And the ship, you know, this Coast Guard ship found us in the middle of the storm. And that was only after I was asked to make a decision. Your listeners may find this interesting, because I wasn't a religious person, still am not a religious
person.
But there I was in this lifeboat, and you imagine yourself in this lifeboat, and there's waves breaking over the side of the lifeboat, and I know I'm dying of hypothermia because I've been a mountaineer, so I know what hypothermia, dying of the cold, I know what it's like. And I and the other seven people in that lifeboat were going to die in 4 or 5 more hours unless we were rescued. And it was getting dark. And while we were hard to see in the daytime because of the storm, as soon as it got dark, we had no flares, no lights, no radio, nothing like that, no equipment to save ourselves. So we had to be found in that last little sliver of daylight, maybe 1 hour. And if it got dark, we were dead for sure. So 1 hour to go. And so there I am. And I finally realized my luck has run out.
This situation actually made you seem to move ahead and really do what you're doing today in the Giraffe Heroes project?
Well, absolutely. Because I had my moment. I think I was talking to whatever the higher power is. I could call it God. I could call it something else. And that higher power said, hey, you know, you're scared. You're scared to be the political activist. You're scared to be the activist. You're scared to be a force for good because it's so painful. It costs so much money. It'll be a terrible life. And it's hard. But you've got to do it because this is who you are now. You have to make a decision. Either you become a force for change or you die out here. There was that start, Julio. That start, right smack in my face. And so I said, okay, I got it. I got it. I got it. I won't look back. I will do what I promised to do, like at the United Nations helping end apartheid. I will do it. And in that instant, this Coast Guard boat comes right at us in the storm, and I'm rescued. So I never looked back after that. I said, okay, that's my answer. That's my answer. So that gave me the courage to keep going, and the rest was kind of free up.
Honestly, it's really amazing and unique story. It is.
Well, it's a story, unique story, sure, but it's also, I think, a good teaching story, and I like to tell it because it is an example of when you want to be an activist, it's scary. There are definitely risks involved, which is why that risk appears in the title of this podcast today. There are risks involved, and you have to steel yourself. You have to get ready to take those risks. And I really wasn't, not until that moment in that lifeboat. And then that finally stiffened my resolve, and it changed my life. And I joined the Giraffe Project, which by then had been started, not by me, but by the person who became my wife, is now my wife.
Sure.
And Medlock, who started the Giraffe Heroes Project, and it was all about finding people who were sticking their necks out, taking risks to help solve serious problems like sustainability problems. And she told their stories. Then in 1980, that was with fax machines and paper PR releases, and ancient stuff that existed almost a half century ago. But she started, and I joined her, and we've been working together on it ever since. So that's the short version of the arc of life of John Graham, who started as an absolute, well, I won't use a nasty word on audio, but started as a real son of a bitch, and my life changed, and I've been working hard to try to make the world a better place.
So, John, can you share some of your stories about the Giraffe Heroes, what countries, and what exactly you guys have been doing on the background for us to share to the audience? How are you helping, you know, the general population? What are your advices? What is your experience in this matter?
Sure. We have now, since 1980s, we've found about 1,500 and counting people around the world who are sticking their necks out, who are taking risks to make their world a better place. And it's not just on environmental issues, it's on every issue. Like I said earlier, it could be corrupt governments or whatever. It could be anything that's a problem for someone in the world. And we find them, and what we're looking for is two things in what we call a giraffe hero. We're looking for two things. The first is that they be taking a risk. Otherwise, they wouldn't be giraffes. This is what we do. The other thing is they have to be doing something that solves a difficult existing problem. They have to be doing it for the common good, not just for themselves or their own family. They have to be doing something for the larger body politic, their community, the nation. Could be something in their community. It could be a huge issue like global warming. Okay. So we're looking for these two qualities. We found about 1,500 people, and we get their stories told. Now, of course, 40 some years later, we tell their stories with the most modern communications we can, social media principally. But also we operate in a lot of, we have subsidiaries in a lot of small countries, mostly in Africa, where they still tell their stories through newspapers and magazines and sure, traditional print. So we get these stories told, and I actually printed out a couple of them in anticipation of our talk today, because your listeners may be wondering, well, who the heck are these giraffe heroes? Well, here's a couple stories, if I may.
Sure, absolutely.
I picked a couple of them that deal with environmental issues, but again, I remind our listeners, that the Giraffe Heroes Project honors people working in many different fields, not just the environment. Here's one. Junior Walk is a coal miner, the son and grandson of coal miners. He's also a keen observer, seeing the ways that mine operations are endangering the lives of his fellow West Virginians and destroying the beauty of their Appalachian mountains. The companies are doing mountaintop removal, turning vast areas into a moonscape. In Walk's area, they're pouring billions of gallons of toxic waste behind a dam made only of dirt and rubble. When he began speaking out against these actions, writing, organizing, and rallying others to stop the mining companies, his father kicked him out of the house. Relatives and neighbors have threatened him, afraid of losing their jobs. But Watt goes on, determined to save the one place he knows and loves. Here's another one. When forest ecologist Rose Abramoff saw that her learned papers on the climate crisis weren't stopping or even slowing the crisis, she left the ivory tower of academe and took action. She chained herself to the White House fence. She was arrested. At a conference at the American Geophysical Union, she unfurled a banner reading, "Out of the lab and into the streets." The banner was ripped out of her hands and the research she had presented was deleted. The protest led to her losing her job at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory for engaging in, quote, personal activity on a work trip, close quote. Abramoff wasn't surprised, and she isn't deterred, saying, "When scientists take action, people listen." And the follow-up, she says, "When scientists take action, they sometimes get fired." Well, it's worth it to Abramoff. "I'm all for decorum," she says, "but not when it will cost us the earth." So, you know, 1,500 stories like that, and they're all inspirational. By the way, I want to tell our listeners that these stories are accessible. They're accessible for free from the Giraffe Project's website, which is giraffe, giraffe.org. Just go up to the nav bar and you'll find a way to navigate to an easily searchable database of these stories. And like I say, one is more inspiring than the next. So that's those are the kind of stories we tell. If I may, Julio, you're probably going to ask me this anyway, but what does stick your neck out mean? I didn't say much about that.
Except yeah, that was my next question.
You're a very smart guy. It's just that, as you may have gathered, my life lesson is if you want to create positive change in the world, sure, and succeed, almost certainly you're going to have to take risks. And I bet every single one of our listeners today understands that. And what are the risks? Well, basically, one of them is sacrificing huge amounts of your time and resources. Another one, more serious perhaps, is getting criticized or abandoned in conflicts with your friends and coworkers who really would prefer that you sit down and shut up, because they may be uncomfortable with the actions you're taking and they may be uncomfortable with your speaking out. Another, and this is even more serious, is that a lot of these, a lot of heroes, a lot of risk takers, people out there who are change agents or want to be change agents, get attacked by corporations who don't want to see change happen because it cuts into their bottom line. Understandable. I mean, fossil fuel companies aren't very happy with all the alternatives to their taking resources out of the ground, fossil fuels. And so they may very well attack you, and they may undermine your research or try to undermine your activities. Government agencies, they're sometimes helpful, yes, but sometimes they're not helpful because they have their own rules and they have their own principles. And if you're messing around urging them
to... And the agenda also.
Yeah, right. Exactly right. So you've got governments and corporations and who are maybe not so happy with you. And sometimes, in some cases, it results in physical threats. Whistleblowers, for example. I suspect that there are a number of whistleblowers on this call. And you know what it's like. I mean, you stick your neck out. You go to testify to your local, to your legislature, or perhaps you publish an inflammatory article in the local newspaper or something, and people come after you, and you can lose your job, and you can get threatening phone calls, and all kinds of things can happen to whistleblowers. So, yes, these are all the risks that we're talking about in the Giraffe Heroes Project. And there are probably many more that I haven't even mentioned, but your listeners probably are aware of.
But I come. Would you think that people in general, I mean, for sure, there are thousands of people out there having this same issue. and they're just afraid of, you know, pulling themselves out because they don't know what to do and who to go or have the proper support for their own life stake, like you say. Would you think so?
Oh, yes, of course. And that's, you know, it's like it's risk-taking is risk-taking. You have to think about it before you do it because you can get hurt for all the reasons that I've just talked about, from losing money to being attacked by a government agency. There's all kinds of things out there. And so people do need encouragement, and that's precisely why we tell these stories. Because you read a story of this guy, the coal miner Walk, or the professor Rose Abramoff, or any of the other stories, and you can't help but be inspired. You're thinking, well, oh, I'm sitting here on my couch, I'm just grousing, I'm just complaining about this assault on the environment in my state or my country or whatever, or this unsustainable practice that no one seems to be criticizing, and here's this coal miner guy, or here's this know-nothing, this professor, and they're sticking their necks out and they're making a difference. So why am I not doing anything? So it inspires people. We are we're following a grand tradition, Julio, at the Giraffe Heroes Project, one that's gone on for tens of thousands of years. Because people have discovered a long time ago, maybe around campfires with cavemen. But if you want to change people's behavior, you got to tell them stories. Storytelling is the most powerful way to change people's behavior. And that's who we are. We're the storytellers of our age. We tell these stories and they inspire other people to either help the hero they hear about in our broadcasts or social media exchanges, or they start their own problem. They start their own organization. And if they're already out there as a hero, I can't tell you the number of letters and messages we get from people like Junior Walk or like Rose Abramoff, who thank us for doing what we're doing because they thought they were all alone. They just got fired. They just lost money. They just got a threatening phone call from their uncle, and they feel alone. And then here comes the Giraffe Project say, oh, no, you're not alone. You're one of a special breed of people who are changing the world. And we're telling your story to as many billions of people as we can. And so it changes their lives. It emboldens them. So our storytelling works in two directions. It both inspires the hero, the risk taker, but it also presents an example to everybody else who hears or sees the story. And we're now, by the way, trying to make them into short videos so young people especially can grab them on their cell phones. I mean, that's why we do it. And it's precisely to try to answer the question you posed a few minutes ago. What do you do? And well, this is why we're trying to answer that question. And also, I must say, doing this for 40 years, we have learned a lot. We've interviewed all these people and we've learned a lot about what to do, what not to do, in order to affect change. And so I've written 5 books on leadership and social change. And I do a lot of speeches and workshops, podcasts, all aimed at helping people become better activists, become more astute and more effective in terms of their political actions, social actions. And there are a lot of things to learn. At some point, I want to tell the story of how I got most of those lessons personally. But just to say that we offer not just inspiration at the Giraffe Heroes Project, we also offer a whole set of finely tuned lessons, coaching tips, if you will, to help people become activists. And there are many of them are in one of my books called Sticking Your Neck Out, which you can get on Amazon. Okay. Stick Your Neck Out. It contains just about everything we know about how to affect change as not only as an environmentalist, but as an agent of change in any area.
So, John, so according to your experience during these 40 years and this stage, I'm pretty sure you faced a lot of circumstances either through government or agencies or whatever force there was. What advice would you tell to someone that wants to stick his neck out for some reason, that is difference of principles or really something that is supposed to be told, but he doesn't know what to do? What this person could do in this matter, for example?
The first thing is to look around and see what is the problem with your name on it. By that, I mean, what problem really concerns you? I mean, maybe it isn't the environment at all. Maybe it's the violence against women in some parts of Africa. In some cases, it's extreme. Maybe
very
it's
common.
But what is the problem for you? What is it that wakes you up at night and say, "Damn it! I just read this story about that problem, and oh, that's terrible. I got to do something about that." Well, it's different for all of us, and I suspect most people on this call, because of how you've created the subject for this podcast, it's going to be on a sustainability issues, and that's great. It's a huge issue. It's an important issue. So it's sustainability. But where do you go? I mean, what happens then? Okay, all right. Yeah, yes. Well, first of all, you do your homework. What precisely is the issue, and what are your talents and skills, and how do you apply them? Let's say, for example, if you happen to be an environmental scientist, well, your path ahead is pretty clear. But if you're not an environmental scientist, what do you do? What if you're just, you know, an ordinary person leading an ordinary life? You're just angry and upset by the climate crisis, for example.
Yes.
Well, you find out what's going on locally. What is it going on locally that might make a difference? For example, maybe there's traffic regulations in your town, or building regulations in your town, or whatever, something going on in your town that's anti-sustainable, and you need to, it needs to stop. Well, you go down to the city council, you do your homework, and you go down to the city council and you complain. I mean, at the most basic level, you write a letter to the editor. At larger and larger levels, of course, there are all kinds of other things you can do. But you look at what your talents are, what you're willing to do, and then you look at the risks. And you realize that if this is really meaningful to you, if solving this problem is meaningful to you, then the risks become meaningful, and you're willing to take them. So then you start. And again, you do more homework. And at this point also, you have to do more than just the head stuff. You have to create a vision of success, a motivating vision of success. This is a very important point. Change agents, in my view, when they're successful, aren't just smart, and they aren't just tough, and they aren't just persistent, and they aren't just aware of their skills and resources, and they also have a mighty vision of the results they want. Now, what is a vision? This is really important. A vision is nothing airy fairy. It's not nothing. It's not some idle wish or a dream. A vision is a picture, a clear, sharp picture of the results you intend to get. And that picture is honed and honed and honed until it is really sharp. A great example in American history, for example, of a huge vision that changed the entire country was the vision of Martin Luther King, the civil rights activist in America. Everybody knows this story. Well, Martin Luther King, when he was a young preacher, he faced a society that was grossly unequal in this country. There was no Civil Rights Act, so it was there were still huge restrictions on giving blacks political power, giving them the right to vote fairly, from keeping them out of restaurants and whatever. There was a rampant segregation in the country. It looked hopeless. It just looked hopeless. And here comes this young preacher, and he starts making small protests, and he starts trying to make a difference. And then at one point early on, he gives a huge speech in Washington, D.C., in front of a couple hundred thousand people, at a time when the southern states and southern counties and southern sheriffs and law enforcement and police officers were bashing the heads of black protesters. This guy King gets up in front of all these people and he gives a speech, and the most famous line in it, and I know many people know this line, Martin Luther King said, "I have a dream. I have a dream." And he goes on to describe a dream, which is his vision. And he goes on to describe with great clarity the vision he has of, how did he put it? The white man and the black man sitting down at the table of fellowship. And he goes on and on and on about what he sees as racial peace and equality in America. That's
what, what would you think, in today's world, at the moment, what would you think we should be done from the governmental point of view and organizations? Let's just say to make a better world.
Yeah. Well, I would say, since we're on the subject of vision, I think it's got to come, you have to start there. What is a vision? What is a vision of sustainability? What does it mean? Now, again, a vision needs to be clear and sharp. It can't just be, oh, I would like it if there was no pollution. Oh, I would love it if my drinking water was clean. Oh, I would love it if they'd stop cutting down all those trees in the Amazon. Oh, I would love it if we'd get rid of fossil fuels. Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, it's nice.
But for that, we need actions.
We need actions. Yeah. You need actions, but the actions have to be motivated because they're scary. We're talking about risk taking. If you're going to take those risks, you have to be motivated to take them. And one of the main ways of doing that is through having a vision. So what is a vision? Okay. The vision of sustainability. What is a clear, sharp picture of what the world looks like or what your country looks like? Let's say in 10 years. Okay. It isn't just some government official in the environmental ministry dreaming up a percentage figure for a number of electric cars, for example, or solar panels. It's a specific picture of what life looks like in that country when, for example, they are 50% weaned off fossil fuels. What does it look like? Oh, well, it means that small things. It means a lot more bike paths. It means adjustments in the workplace. It means new kinds of insulation in our building codes. It means. And so you spend a lot of time looking at the specifics, not now, but 10 years from now, because that's when you set this vision. Yeah. It's 2034. You put yourself into the year 2034, and you look around. You invent people to talk to. You get what people are saying in 2034, living in an environment which is greatly improved in terms of sustainability than it is now in 2024, and you get very clear about what that means down to the smallest detail. What are your kids learning in school about solar panels, for example? What have the scientists done in those 10 years about creating solar panels that are so cheap anybody can make them? How about batteries, for example? There's been a revolution in the construction of batteries, which allows every home to generate its own electricity, etc. Go on and on and on. All of this exists in 2034. And when the picture of what it looks like in 2034 is really clear, then you do what I call in my books back planning. If it looks this way in 2034, let's just take this one aspect of batteries being so good that every individual home can heat itself no matter where it is because of batteries and solar power. Okay, and this is how what we're looking at in 2034. Well, in 2029, halfway there, 5 years from now, we've made some progress, but we're not there. So what does it look like in 2029? Well, the batteries are getting cheaper, but they're still not cheap enough. Okay, all right. So let's look 3 years ahead. It's 2027. Okay, this is where we are in terms of global warming. This is where we are in terms of calving icebergs in Antarctica. I mean, this is different aspects of sustainability, global warming.
When do you think that should be more programs and more action regarding sustainability, especially from government point of view, Would you think that they're doing enough, for example, for the last 15, 20 years?
No, of course not. And I want to make clear to our listeners that I am not an environmental scientist. Almost everyone on this call knows more about the technical side of these issues than I do. But what I am is I'm a people scientist, if you will. I know how to motivate people. And so what we have not done a good enough job is motivate enough people in those last 15 years. I mean, it's not shameful, but it's disappointing. The progress from the Paris Peace Accords, the Paris Climate Accords, for example. There's some great promises made by the Biden administration and even by the Chinese administration. And that's wonderful. But what do we really get? How do we really get the average man on the street to accept the changes necessary to create a sustainable world? And this is what we have to do in terms of motivating them. It can't just be electing a new progressive president or prime minister. It's got to be moving the center of gravity, the political center of gravity in the country. There's got to be a popular force behind it, and we're beginning to create that. I mean, I'm here in Seattle, Washington State, way off in a corner of the United States, and we're making some progress. The mayor has announced some new policies for Seattle, who does an okay job and environmental concerns, but it could do a lot better. And so, you know, we're making progress, but you need to convince this political center of gravity that it's necessary. And for that, you need activists who are willing to take the risks and who are willing to create a vision which is infectious. You create the vision, what I'm talking about, 2034, all these changes. And then the vision has to not stay with you. It's got to be communicated to people. And you communicate it by telling stories. Here we're circling back to the Giraffe Project. These people.
Would you say there's enough communication? Would you say that people really got the information reached? Or there's still a lot of much more work to do informing people in the right way?
I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that people need more information, but will they read it? I mean, we're now in a society that is utterly buried in information, most of which
is social media and visual. And
not all of it is the truth. I mean, we know not all of it is the truth. So it's got to be more than just intellect. Even if the information is right, it has to be more than just information coming into your brain. You have to be motivated to do it, and you have to be motivated because it's risky to do it. And taking a risk, you have to have a reason to take those risks. Otherwise, why would you be a fool and take a risk for nothing? You got to be prepared to take those risks, and you take those risks because of what happens if you don't take the risk. And that isn't enough. You can't just, my view is that you can't just scare people into doing the right things. It helps for the short term. In the short term, I can say, whoa, if that ice shelf in Antarctica breaks off, it's the size of the American state of Rhode Island, and sea levels will rise a foot and a half. Oh, my God, that's going to just ruin Bangladesh and Miami and whatever. Oh, that'll scare some people into changing their behavior. But much better is to create positive incentives. That if we can create a sustainable world, all kinds of good things will happen. Not just bad things will be avoided, but the vision has to be of the good things that will happen. For example, our great-grandchildren will live up in a world where they won't be fried, where crops will grow, where, you know.
I think we have to find to have the mentality of focusing. Oh, firstly, not being selfish, because the society itself is transforming people these days. But thinking in the future, you know, it's not just you or yourself or the ones around you. There's future generations of people coming through, and they need to be properly informed in a way to get there. Otherwise, no one will get there. And I think this is the big scenario that we've always been facing.
Yeah, I agree with you. And Julio, may I tell a story of my own personal sort of like how I sort of came by some of these ideas, because I'm a storyteller, right? And so you and I can talk on an intellectual basis about all the things that need to be done or haven't been done, and that's very good because both you and I are smart guys and we communicate well, so fine. But I want to tell a story, which is I hope will reach people's heart as well as their heads.
Sure.
I was I've been out here in Island County, Washington State. And Island County, Washington State is an island north of Seattle that is rural. But from time immemorial, because America is such a young country, but from the time that Island County was settled around 1880, it's been controlled white guys with money. We call them the good old boys. I mean, they sort of control things. And they don't want to be questioned, and they run the county commission, which is our legislature here in the county, forever. And when Washington State decided, to their great credit, to create a sustainability act called the Growth Management Act in 1990. It was a great piece of legislation, and it does all the right things in terms of wanting to keep rural places rural, deal with issues of habitat, clean air, clean water, all that good stuff. And the legislatures in Washington State did that. And here in Island County, these good old boys ignored it because they ignored laws. They didn't like it. This is what it was. So when Ann and I moved here in 1982, it was into an environment in which, even though the state had passed the correct laws to allow sustainability actions, they weren't being taken because the good old boys, the power structure in the county, wouldn't allow it to take place. So we formed a group to force them to do that. And we called it the Smart Growth Coalition. And I was the leader of it. And we gathered a bunch of people, not many, it was 30 or 40 people, who insisted that the county leaders had to obey the state's Growth Management Act and create a comprehensive plan for sustainability in Island County, dealing with every aspect of it, from habitat to clean air, clean water, all the rest of it. Well, the county commissioners, the good old boys, laughed in our faces. This was a challenge that they were just going to dismiss. But we were right. The first thing we did was we took them to court. We used the legal system, and we forced them to get serious about creating this comprehensive plan. But they were smart, and they created some draft plans that were meaningless, that were just full of stupid soft words that without any teeth in them. So we got tougher and tougher, and it became a battle royal. It went on for 8 years, from 1992 to the year 2000, it split the county into a number of factions. There was an environmental faction, which I was the leader of, and then there were real estate developers, people who made money off selling land. There were the good old boys, the power structure in the capital, and there were farmers and foresters, many from traditional families that really didn't like any laws at all that restricted their use of private property. The farmers wanted to plant wherever they wanted to plant. The foresters wanted to cut down every damn tree they could. The county was badly split over all of these issues. And we realized in the Smart Growth Coalition, and here's the important point. We realized that you can't just affect change through legal systems. Yes, we were winning at least half the court fights. We were forcing the county to take notice, okay? But we also understood that the minute our backs were turned, someone would come back and undo all of our work, because it only depended upon who was in office at the time. If we could pass a law, it would be unpassed. It would be repealed. And so it'd be a constant fight between these forces of, it's simplistic to say they were environmental forces versus anti-environmental forces. It was more complicated than that. But it was the farmers, the foresters, the land, the real estate developers, the county officials. Something had to be done. And this goes back to something we were talking about 20 minutes ago, Julio. to create the political, the change in the political center of gravity, to change people at a heart level. And so that's what we determined to do. We still kept suing the county, taking them to court. But at the same time, we made a huge effort to understand our opponents. And this is really important. For example, in the beginning, farmers opposed what we were doing because we were suggesting they had to start fencing in wetlands so that their cattle couldn't defecate all over the place and endanger the water table. Okay. Farmers didn't want to do that. They didn't want fences at all. So we spent a lot of time with farmers understanding issues like placing fences. And we found out stuff that we, the environmentalists, didn't know. For example, when you fence in a certain amount of land, that means you can't use it. And if you can't use the land, that means your land is less valuable. And that means you can't get loans from the bank in order to buy seed for the next year's crop or maybe send your kid to college. We didn't understand that. But then we began to understand farm economics. And when we began to understand farm economics and show some sympathy for it, at the same time, we developed some trust with the farmers, and they began to realize that we weren't some leftist rabble trying to ruin their lives, but we were simply people, citizens, caring about clean air and clean water. We didn't want to drink water that their cattle had been defecating in, and neither did they. So we began to get closer and closer, and some of it was just spending hours sitting on hay bales listening to people, farmers, foresters, whatever. And we began to develop this political center of gravity I've been talking about. And we began to shift things so that it became not just four or five different factions. We became one faction, okay? And it was interesting because when push came to shove and some of the key decisions had to be made, I remember very clearly that on one issue that concerned farms and fences, it was a farmer that made the compromise suggestion that solved the problem, not an environmentalist. And it, on another issue that should have been a farmer's issue, it was an environmentalist that's talked in favor of the farmer's point of view, because we had spent 2 years building trust, creating this political center of gravity. And the upshot of it is that now the plan, after 25 years, is up for its review. And in 25 years, things haven't changed. That we forced the county to adopt a comprehensive plan, but by then we had created that political center of gravity, and the plan that we created still exists. It's hardly changed at all because people believe it. They believe in it. We've created a whole new way of looking at sustainability in this county through
John, to conclude this part, what is the message that you would give to people and governments in the matter of sustainability? What do you think would be the correct approach to starting reducing CO2 according to the actual average, which we're not complying year by year? And what will be your idea of setting up program or an idea for government to start, settling up and organizing a way of having a roadmap to get that proper reduction?
I think a lot of good stuff is being done already to answer those serious questions that you're raising. I think the ideas behind the Paris Climate Accords were excellent. And I think some governments really are trying to do the right thing. And a lot of it is very self-interested, but who cares? I mean, if it leads us to the right place. So I think there's progress being made. Slowly but surely, opinions are shifting. But there still is a great lack of mistrust. I sense that the biggest mistrust is between the North and the South. You may agree with this. And many of your listeners may also agree with it, that the South really resents the fact that it's been the North that created a lot of the problem through indiscriminate burning of fossil fuels for a century. And now the South is being asked to pick up the damage. And the refugee crisis is we're seeing now will be minor compared to the refugee crisis we'll see if global warming is allowed to proceed. So we have to go back to the two elements that I talked about earlier. There has to be a joint vision of change, one that people from Angola and California can agree on, one that deal with sustainability issues in terms of their effect on humankind and the creation of an entire planet. Because we can't just create a planet safe for the European-oriented world. We have to create it's one planet. I mean, it's one climate. Everybody knows that. We have to create it. It's either solve the problem worldwide or don't solve the problem.
And general people need to understand they all live in the same planet. It doesn't matter what kind of resources you have, you still live in the same planet. See, I think this is the general idea that some people are in some level, some other in that level, and they think that's different. Well, in the end, you live still in the same planet, same environment, and same stage. And it's something very clear to us forward.
Well, I hope too, but I think you and I would agree that it's got to be more than hope. We need practical plans, and they exist. But let's go back to this whole question of a vision. What's a vision in 2034? A planet-wide vision of change, based on the principles of the Paris Accords, for example. What does it look like? What does it look like for the entire planet? For the North and the South to be in a broad agreement of what needs to happen. Well, there's got to be some significant actions on carbon and fossil fuel and carbon dioxide emissions. At the same time, there has to be some realization on the part of the North that a whole lot of money has got to be put into the South to allow them to continue to grow without making all the mistakes that the developed nations made a century ago in terms of profligate burning of fossil fuels. That's going to take a lot of money, and it's going to take big hunks of budgets of the United States and the European nations. So it's got to be have to be a really strong vision for people to see that it's in the North's interests to listen to the South, and it's got to be in the South. The vision, the South has got to understand that it's got to understand where the North is coming from. And its demands have to be such that they don't just create more anger and resistance, but create the possibility of compromise.
You know, I mean, us in Global Consulting, we designed a program back 2 years ago, and we've been trying to develop it in many countries. And what it is we advise according to analytical, because of course each country is very different, it's like a person. So according to analytics of each country, after we do a thorough analysis, we come up with a kind of solution for the government to subsidize partly in a percentage for companies and people to start reducing CO2, which means optimizing energy, reducing the usage of energy, because it can be done optimizing it. And with that, on the reductions, they get also subsidies of carbon credits. So we've been trying implementing this all around the world, but it's not having really the traction that we want to. And I think if every country does this, in the end, even if they reduce 1 or 2%, we're talking about over, for example, 100 countries reducing 1%. We're talking about maybe get on the level of reduction, even over 11%, which is what we're trying to achieve, reaching 2030. And the actual traction that we are having at this moment, I don't think we're going to get there. I mean, this is the vision and the practice experience from our side. I mean, what would you say? What is your experience regarding this?
Well, my first reaction is that what you're describing is very important for everyone to hear. And I totally agree with you. And I totally also agree with you that where we need to go is way beyond where we're going right now. There needs to be more progress, but along the lines that scientists and people like yourself have already laid out for us. I mean, what to do specifically, what to do technically is pretty clear. Yeah, there are some ideas way out in the future, geoengineering and whatever, directly affecting the atmosphere by, I don't know what, some scientific means that haven't even been invented yet. It's worth thinking about. But the measures that can be taken now are pretty well known from, for example, capping fracking wells, because we're beginning to understand now that the most dangerous thing about fracking is the methane being released, which is 10 times more powerful than CO2, is a greenhouse gas.
True.
And so we're learning how to cap methane. We're building electric cars, and we're finally understanding that we have to make significant investments in charging stations all across the world. So the technology isn't the problem. The world seems to be full of great scientists and engineers who are eager to tell us. I was talking with a guy in South Africa, for example, the other day, who has come up with a new form of hydrogen fusion power, which most scientists regard as impossible. Well, this guy says he's done it, and he's no dope. So yeah, maybe you know, someday there'll be hydrogen fusion power, which would be great because the only byproduct of that is you're.
I think hydrogen will be definitely the future. Because it's the most sustainable and cheaper to produce in the end. Not from the beginning, but in the long stage, it's much cheaper to produce.
Yeah.
And in the end, it only comes out water vapors, you know. So I think definitely it's going to be the future in that.
Oh, I agree. But then again, Julio, we're talking about technical solutions, and I have admitted that I'm no expert in that. So I mean, you and others on this call know more than I do, so I'm not going to embarrass myself by trying to be technical when I don't have the knowledge. But what I do know is that the progress you're talking about is only going to happen if we can break through the traditional restraints, and a lot of those restraints are bureaucratic, they're monetary, they're things like greed, for example. So many people are simply unwilling, just like the farmers and the foresters in Island County in the story I told. They're unwilling to see change because it means it could hit them in the pocketbook. Or worse than that, it could force them to change what their grandfathers did or their fathers did. And for that, you have to appeal to not the head, but the heart. And this is circles back to my contribution to this discussion is not to, all I can do is shake my head in agreement when you talk about the specific things that you're an expert in. I agree with you, but I'm saying, sure. how do you get there? And it really comes down to how do you master the risks? And you master the risks by looking at creating a vision.
And sometimes also the interest from the other party. Because sometimes there's also a difference of interest, a difference of policy, and this is what it shouldn't do. I mean, I have experience, for example, deploying a project in a country that swapped government 4 times in less than 4 years. So it's a big problem because the policy not becoming the same, and they change it one after the other, and in the end, so what is the roadmap? So this is what I'm trying to expose out there. It doesn't matter what happens in the contingency of the government itself. There has to be policy, and those policies have to be maintained and passed forward from government to government. I mean, you cannot just deny a policy, for example, in sustainability. And then when comes the new government, they're going to say, no, this is not really good. We're going to change to some other thing. Well, and this is what we've been facing also in many countries.
Sure. It's a continuity is important. And it kind of circles back to what I was saying in terms of my small county here in Washington State. There has to be continuity. And if you rely only on legislative and judicial fixes and wonderful statements like the Paris Statement, you're going to be constantly looking over your shoulder and you're going to be constantly complaining about slow progress because you'll be dragging people along in compliance. And dragging people into compliance means that as soon as your back is turned, someone will drag them back.
And also transparency, because this is the other side. Because people then, when they put programs, they put a huge amount of policy and compliance, almost impossible for everyone to be compliant. And it should be something available to everyone for everyone to get the benefit of reducing CO2. But sometimes some policies get so complex itself that not even people want to apply or even understand how to apply it. I mean, there's a lot of examples, you know, we saw in some countries. Transparency in the end is the most important thing above, the compliance and everything else.
Well, it's interesting you use the word transparency because it circles back to my refrain about creating a vision. You know, let me be very clear, very practical in terms of my own personal of me being part of the problem. My wife wants me to get an electric car. I live in a county. Lots of dirt roads and stuff, and I haul heavy loads and stuff, and electric car. Okay, there aren't enough charging stations in Washington State yet, so I don't want to buy an electric car, and so I'm resisting buying an electric car. And part of it is that I don't want to change. I'm 81 years old. I like driving my Subaru. It's a tough little car. It does what I want it to do. It gets 28 miles a gallon, so it's not great, but it's okay. I forget about the fact that I'm ignoring the larger issue. Now, if I force myself or someone leads me to by telling stories into creating a picture of how the world looks like when my grandchildren are my age, for example, and in a world in which electric cars are the norm, and I'm painted a picture of what the world looks like with a hugely reduced amount of CO2 emissions because of the use, for example, of electric cars and redesign of office buildings and all the other good things that we know are on the drawing boards, then I say, that's a terrific future. I like that future. Oh, okay, that's the future. What's that got to do with me? Oh, wait a minute, that future doesn't leap like a gazelle from 2024 to 2084. It has to be built. So if my grandchildren are experiencing this world in which sustainability is in fact going fine, and the North-South problems have been somehow eased, and that we're all moving forward more or less on the same page, that means that in 2050 there has to be some significant amount of progress in order for the result we want in 2084. Okay, if there's that amount of progress by 2050, then in 2024, goddammit, John Graham better buy an electric car, because that's my part of getting to 2084. And sure. I do that by being convinced of the value of the vision of the world my grandchildren will be living in, and then working backward to what that means in terms of what my actions have to be as their grandfather in 2024. So, is that a form of transparency? I guess it is, but it's a kind of personal transparency of me being honest about my own resistances and then realizing that legislators and captains of industry and whatever have their own resistances, but it's built up out of human resistances. And a lot of it is fear of change, again, right back to risk taking. It's fear of losing money, again, risk. It's being made to look like a fool when all of your friends think climate change is a hoax, and you're getting up there and saying it's not a hoax. All of these risks have to be overcome. And I've already described a lot how I think they can be overcome.
John, so it's really interesting experience you have all your life stage. I'm really wondered, you know, all you've been through in all your life, and you still had that vision of helping people. What would be, you know, your final advice to people in general on what to do to get, you know, kind of a roadmap to the future?
How much time do we have? Okay, I'll try and make this short as I can. I think the first thing is to do what we've been talking about a lot, especially you today, and that's do your homework. Don't go off half-cocked. Don't go off just angry. Don't go off because your neighbor is still using a single-stroke gasoline engine or whatever, or your mayor or the prime minister of your country refuses to believe in that global warming is real. Don't just stop there and complain. Do your homework. What in fact is happening, what is not happening. You don't have to become a scientist, but you do have to understand the impacts of global sea rise. You do have to understand the impending super crisis of immigration caused by climate crisis. You do have to understand the possibilities that science is presenting, especially in technologies in creating super batteries, stuff like that. So you do your homework. That's at the most basic level. Second, look at the stakeholders. That is to say, the people who will be affected by actions that you want to promote. Who are they? Who will benefit? And who thinks they'll be hurt by them? It's important to know both sides. My grandchildren will be benefited. The people digging coal out of the ground in West Virginia will probably not be benefited. So who are your supporters? And then don't try and do it alone. And that's not a problem because there are so many people now interested in combating climate change. You build allies, but you have to also select your allies so that the team you build has all the qualities that you need to make a difference. And this goes back to what I learned in creating the change here in Island County. It wasn't just a bunch of activists who were good speakers. We had to create a comprehensive team. We had to have technical people. We had to have people who are expert in media, and now that means social media. We had to have fundraisers because it takes money. And we had to have legal advice. We had to have attorneys that could stand by us in court when we had to. So you create a team and you understand your stakeholders. Especially your opponents. And with your opponents, where are they coming from? Where are your opponents coming from? Well, for example, the nations from the South that are bitterly complaining against some of the aspects of the climate accords, where are they coming from? Well, I think we've already talked about that. They feel screwed because they didn't cause the climate crisis. The North caused it, and they're being asked to help pay for it. So, you know, what arguments will sway these people in the South? I suspect they'll come down to money. I mean, like huge amounts of money. That's important. And you can look if all you want about the money needed to affect real climate change against the money being used to promote the various wars going on in the world today. And you see that we're spending far more on military than we are in sustainability, and that's a problem. Fourth, what are the opportunities for building trust? I mean, The opportunities for building trust with the South are all over the place. I mean, I used to be head of America's section at the American Mission for the United Nations, and I was head of the section that dealt with the so-called, we called it then, the Third World, the South, the developing nations. And there wasn't much trust at all, but it wasn't that hard to build it. All you had to do was sit down with people
from the countries
and say,
I am the effort.
Yeah, make the effort, show that you care, yeah. And then make some, and then start making positive advances. That's how we ended apartheid, for example. We got a lot of nations to understand that nobody was comfortable, except perhaps the South Africans and a few other right-wing governments. Nobody was comfortable with it. And once we realized that, some progress was important and necessary. And then finally, and this is the most important, and I'm sorry, I'm getting a little long-winded, and I said I wouldn't, but...
It's okay. That's good.
Udo, the biggest
for the sake of the audience.
Okay, the biggest thing is personal motivation. The biggest thing is motivation. You have to... I ask all of your listeners to return to the question of why this work in promoting sustainability is meaningful to them. I mean, personally meaningful. Remind yourself, I say to our listeners today, of why you're doing this work. Why? And think of all those who will benefit from the work and how it impacts their future. And I'm not just talking about your grandchildren.
And then they have to feel it's important to you. And this is I think it's one of the most important parts of the situation when you empower yourself and think about it.
Yes. And then finally, and this is to me the most important point, but this is where I think I can offer something. And that is to look inward, look at yourself. It's important to remind yourself that the work you're doing for sustainability brings a lot of personal meaning into your own heart, your own soul, whatever you want to call it. We all have different words for it. And there's nothing more important to any person that their lives be meaningful. Let's face it. You look at the mirror in the morning and you want to know that someone looking back at you is not on a planet just to take up space. You're not just on this planet just to mark time. You're here for a purpose. Otherwise, why would you be here? I don't have to be religious to say that, or I don't have to wear a white gown to be spiritual. This makes common sense. You're here for a reason. What is that reason? We all want a life.
And people don't need to feel meaningless.
That's right.
They all afford something to the, you know, to the contribution, to the grain of sand, I used to say.
Yeah.
If everyone puts in, they need to feel that whatever you're doing, it's important. And I think this is one of the facts that governments and organizations don't spread out the information in such a way.
Yeah. Well, look at yourself. I mean, how many hours does it take for you to prepare one of these podcasts? You do a marvelous job, but it takes hours. I know that. And it takes resources. Okay. Why do you do that? I'm not paying you to do it. You're doing it because you know it's the right thing to do. Because you know you know you're a good speaker. You know you're persuasive, and you know how to attract good people to your cause. That's who you are. So you're using your skills because it's meaningful to you. Because now you look at the mirror in the morning, and who looks back at you is someone who is today, tomorrow, the next day.
You're improving yourself.
The world.
Feel good yourself because you know you're doing a good thing and you know that what you're doing is going to help people in some way and even develop situations of action. You know, this is my main point.
Yes, and let's be honest here. You're doing it for other people, sure, and that's wonderful. But I think that you and me, we have to also be a little bit selfish. We're also doing it to enrich our own lives. Because what you're doing, you wouldn't do it unless you came away from these sessions with a smile. Like, oh, man, me and Graham did a pretty good job out there today. I hope we convinced some people, okay? And that'll make a difference. So you're doing it to enrich your own life, to create meaning, more meaning in your own life. So that's maybe the last point, is that this business of fighting for sustainability, it's not all sacrifice by any means. Because by finding something that's more meaningful to you, so that person looking back at you in the mirror says, hey, good job, that enriches our life. So when they finally put you in a box and bury you or burn you or whatever you're going to do, you're satisfied. Like, hey, I made a difference. I'm cool. I made a difference. And that Absolutely. Impact on your personal life is hugely important. And I say that whether you're religious or not.
Absolutely. John, what will be your final message to everyone?
My final message to... My final message. I don't think I have a final message.
No, just do short enough.
If I do have a final message, it's like, okay, you've just heard for an hour now Julio and me talking about sustainability issues, and Julio has brought his wonderful experience in the intricacies of climate change and the like. And I have focused more on my experience of dealing with personal motivations for change. And I hope the two of us together have created a symbiosis that comes together. But it really comes down to not just do your homework, but create a vision. And then do something that creates meaning in your life. Because as you do something that creates meaning in your life, for sure, it's going to be something of service. And if you're oriented towards sustainability issues, it'll be something in that area. And that's how you will affect change, by doing something that's personally meaningful, that makes your, that lights you up, that makes you alive. In doing that, you will make all of us more alive.
Perfect. John, it was a real pleasure to have you on this episode. I really enjoy it. I hope we do a next one, maybe in kind of different trajectory or subject, according to what more specific what you do. I advise all our audience to subscribe our channels. We'll be catching up next Friday. Then we're going to talk about Montenegro and investment. And I hope you all enjoyed this episode. John, anything else you'd like to add on?
Did I put in enough plugs for my websites?
Yes, we're all going to put in everything on the description of this video. All the information is going to be exposed.
Okay, I'm just checking, that's all. Thank you very much. I greatly enjoyed it. I think it's a wonderful show, and I'm so delighted to be a part of it.
Thank you, John. Thank you.